Bem-vindos ao podcast do canal Sanada, com entrevistas com pessoas muito interessantes. Viva aventuras, viagens, experiências extraordinárias ao redor do mundo e além.
Good evening, this is Alexander Moore. I'm the board of directors and a fellow of the Explorers Club, and I'm here to introduce Yuri Sanada this evening for tonight's lecture. Yuri's subject tonight follows some of the longest tradition of the Explorers Club, where we had people like Thor Iredal, who used the Kon-Tiki raft, a recreation of an Indonesian raft, to go across the Pacific and prove that the trip could be done the opposite way to what has been historically proven. Yuri's expedition proved to do the same with a Phoenician reconstruction of a ship that was built based on a Phoenician shipwreck from the 6th century BC that I can actually show you on a map in a minute. Yuri is also a NAWI certified diving instructor and who operated a successful diving operation for a long time. Since 1998, he has been creating a TV series and documentaries about nature, exploration, and adventures, such as the first Brazilian IMAX movie, Amazon Adventure 3D. From 2008 to 2010 and 2019 to 2020, Yuri was a partner of two expeditions aboard the replica Phoenician ship I just mentioned from 600 BC. And his studio is home and home in Brazil, where he's going to reach us from tonight, is an energy efficient and sustainable building made of recycled materials, such as old tires and PET bottles, and a new trend of sustainable construction that we're seeing all over the world. So before that, have a guest come in and say hi from another world when CO2 was much higher. She's a little challenged, but she's actually teaching me how about higher CO2 levels and what the world did when that was the case, and how the world survived climate change. Her name is T-Rex Kant, and she's a lovely partner in research. So here I'll show you where the Yuri's wreck comes from. This is a map of all shipwrecks from the Bronze Age all the way to the modern period, which we have been creating at Harvard. It's called Mapping Past Societies, or MAPS at Harvard. And it is created by one of our fellows, Santiago Pardo Sanchez, who's managing editor. I'm on the editorial board, and Santi is one of our treasures at the Explorers Club as well, and at Harvard. And here you can see the date of the wreck and the depth and where it was found. So, without further additions and jokes from me, here is Yuri to you.
Hi, good evening, everybody. It's a pleasure to be here to be part of this club. It's very exciting. I just joined last year in September, just before the expedition, actually. So it's amazing to be here talking to you all. From Brazil. I'd like to start talking about a little bit about expedition, about the, you know, the process to put this together. Actually, it's the expedition leader, Philip Bill, a British friend of mine, a partner in the project, who put this two expeditions we're going to talk about together, one from 2008-2010, and this one from last year to begin of this year. This is our ship from up above. It's a shot I took from a drone in the middle of the Atlantic. Very exciting to fly this. And there's nothing, you know, nowhere in sight to land. Just a little ship moving in the waves. That's our little ship. That's how we went around Africa, and that's how we crossed the Atlantic Ocean. But first, I want to tell you why we did that, why we tried to emulate what the Phoenicians did. So let's start by talking or asking, who were the Phoenicians? Okay, we know a lot about the Romans, about the Greek. We know a lot about the Chinese. But the Phoenicians, even though they were very important, we don't know much about them. They're kind of forgotten by history. It's very nice to know, to remember them, because they were the best sailors of antiquity. They were the guys who invented a lot of things about the ships that we even use today. And they're not conquerors. They're not like, you know, people who go there and try to destroy civilization. They would go to a different place to trade, to be merchants, and even to colonize. And they existed for a long, long time, thousands of years, until the Romans end them in 146 BC. Well, these people, they started in the Middle East. They started in the Lebanon and Syria area. And from there, they had the cider, the trees, they built ships, they started to sail. So they were the guys responsible to have the phonetic alphabet shared with the world. The alphabet you use today, the phonetic alphabet, phonetic because each letter has a sound. It's different from like hieroglyphs where a drawing has a meaning of a sentence or a word. These guys developed this technology where each letter had a sound and they put it together and they could produce words. And only 24, 23 different symbols. So very easy to teach. So that's how they got around the Mediterranean, even further than that, teaching how to, you know, write and so that they could communicate better. They also invented insurance. Take, for example, 10 ships go out at sea to try to trade like in Britain or in Italy from Lebanon. So if one of those ships sank during the voyage there or coming back, the other 9 captains would chip in and build a new ship for this guy. So it's the first kind of insurance we had in the ancient civilization. So that's what they did. They also invented the glass blowing, or how to produce glass, blowing a tube in a molten glass. And of course, the color purple that even today we associate with royalty, with you know, the kings and emperors, came from the Phoenicians. We're going to talk about that a little bit later. They introduced olive oil and wine to the West. So these guys are very, very important, even though we don't know about them. We don't know much about them outside the academic circles. And they invented the navigation by the pole star and other navigation techniques we're going to talk about with a few slides. So basically, this is the area they started. They started from Byblos or Beirut and Tyre in Lebanon, all the way to Arwad in Syria, south of Syria. And then they sailed all over the Mediterranean, going all the way outside into the Atlantic Ocean, all the way to Morocco. And maybe, as we try to prove, even came to America, to the Americas. Now, because these people are so forgotten, they are so left outside of the mainstream history, people don't talk about them anymore. They talk about, like I said, Romans, Greek, not about Phoenicians. There's so many legends that were built around these guys. And this is one of them. There's a Phoenician coin from 341 BC. And some people say there's a world map just below the raw horse. And that's a debate that's been going on for some time. And that's just part of it. So there's a lot of legends, even though in those days, they maybe went outside the Mediterranean and discovered Americas, they wouldn't, you know, spread the word. They wouldn't say, oh, okay, I found this land and it's full of gold and full of riches, because there was no way to register that, to guarantee the property for them. So they would spread rumors. So saying that outside the pillars of Hercules, outside Gibraltar into the Atlantic Ocean, the world ended. There will be monsters. There will be, you know, something, some creatures that will destroy your ship and swallow you whole. So that's a way of keeping you afraid and not following them, not going where they went to get the riches. And then came this guy, Christopher Columbus, of course. World famous, everybody knows about them from Genova. But the thing is, Columbus had the right idea. He sailed west in search of a new land. Everybody knows that. He discovered America. And in Brazil, we don't have Christopher Columbus as a discoverer. We have Cabral, Pedro Álvares Cabral, the Portuguese, around the same time, 1500, he came to Brazil. But the thing is, how did these guys, how did they know they could sail to west and find land? Of course, there's maps, there's a lot of speculation, there's a lot of different evidence that they knew something about that. They knew the red lands to the west, at least China. But let me tell you, I have a little information I like to share, and I think it's new because I didn't see anywhere else. If somebody saw it, please let me know. But if you go to the Bible, and that's a very good document, besides if you believe or not in God and everything, but it's a very good archaeological document sometimes. And if you go to the Book of Kings, they mention the Phoenicians, of course. They were very, very important. The Phoenicians, basically, they went to a place called Ophir to get the gold and the material to build the Temple of Solomon, the Temple of Jerusalem. That's historically in the Bible. So King Solomon, he wants to build the temple for the Ark of Covenant. He goes to the Phoenician, his neighbor, the king, his friend, Hiram, say, please build me the temple. And then they build a fleet of ships, like the one we sailed, and went to someplace and took them three years to go there and back with all the material to build the temple. Now, the important thing here is, going to the right page here, when Christopher Columbus came back from this fourth voyage, he didn't find the gold he promised the King and Queen of Spain, the sponsors of the original voyage. So what they did, they called him and brought him in chains, people say, because they wanted the gold. Okay, we sponsored 4 expeditions. You didn't bring us gold. Where's the gold you promised? So here's the important part. And this is from this 4th letter. It's a book you can buy, you know, online or anywhere. And it shows that he wrote on his own, you know, by his own hand, Christopher Columbus, that I declare that those mines of Aurea are one and the same as these of Veragua, which, as I have said above, extended westward 20 days journey. So here is Columbus quoting the Bible, quoting that he promised the king or queen of Spain exactly where to find the gold. He said, I'm going after the same gold, Aurea, that Solomon bought from the Phoenicians. So that's a direct quote, historical, that's saying that Columbus believed in the Phoenicians going to the West and bring the gold and all the material and the wood and birds and everything they used to build the Temple of Solomon. So it's just a little theory and cooking. Of course, it's we use that in part to help, you know, believing that we could cross the Atlantic, since it's written in the Bible and everything, and many other books as well. So it's very nice to know that Christopher Columbus was the guy who believed in what I'm going to talk to you about. Now, this guy is Captain Philip Beale. He's a very good friend. He's a very nice guy. And he's the captain who designed and commanded the ship and the expeditions, both expeditions around Africa and also the expedition across the Atlantic going to the Americas. That's Philip, and should be listening now. Okay, the ship was constructed, like Alex said, based on 2 shipwrecks, the Jules Verne, found in the area called Jules Verne, south of France. But the ship was built, designed from those plants, from those shipwrecks, and was built in Arwad, a small island in the south of Syria. That's, of course, before the war, that was 2008. And from there, here's some of the aspects of the construction in that very, very nice place. It's very beautiful, very small island. You can see here, it's very interesting. The ship, the planks are put first. First, they build the hull of the ship of very strong, very thick wood. And then they come inside and do the caves and do the skeleton. So it's like opposite to what they do today. Nowadays, they first build the skeleton, the ribs, and then they put the planks outside. The Phoenicians did the other way. And this is called the Phoenician joint by the Romans. Okay, to join one plank to the other, there's a pin linking the 2 planks. And then there's an olive wood pin going across and locking it. There's thousands of that small pins going all over the ship to make it very, very safe, very secure. And that's called, like I said, the Phoenician joint by the Romans. So that's something they also invented and made navigation a lot safer. So this is the trial. Then the ship went to water, first time in Arawat, and it's floating. It's wonderful. So after the ship was done, that was 2008, and took a few months to be built by a family in Syria, a very nice family who built traditional ships. Even to this day, they built some traditional ships there. Not like this, of course, but more modern fishing ships. These guys, they built this very strong ship for us. And then what we did is we took the ship to go around Africa. So Philip took a crew, volunteers from different countries. I think there was, at the total of this expedition, was 50 people from 15 different countries that joined different stages, different legs, and they sail all the way around Africa. And of course, a ship like that is not like a normal yacht. So there's a lot of work to be done. Even to put the sail up, and it's like a 1-ton sail, takes 8 men to do that, because everything it's manual. There's nothing electric or anything that's, you know, a wind or anything that can winch can help you put the sail up or steer the boat. No, it's all natural, all based in what we discovered from archaeological sites, from museums, from drawings and vases and stuff like that. Of course, Philip is British, so the ship, even though it's Phoenician built in Syria, has a British flag, and that's a ship sailing across the ocean. That's Vera, my wife. She's at the helm. And you can see there are 2 helms. She's holding one. She's steering the ship with 1 helm. There's another one on the other side, on the port side. And in the middle, there's a small one. We don't have a small engine aboard, you know, to go into harbors, ports, because it's very scary when we are crossing the ocean or going to a very busy port. And there's like 10, 20 big ships, cargo ships crossing around at 20, 10, 15, 20 knots. And you are trying to make your way under 2 or 3 knots. So it's very easy to, you know, to get run over if you don't have an engine to get out of the way of the ships. So that's what we did. Oops. Oh, so here's our toilet. Like I said, this ship is not a conventional ship. It's not very comfortable. So that's what we have as a toilet. This is the shower and the toilet we had. It's an outboard toilet. So it's very easy, just like a hole in a blanket in the middle of the ocean. And that's how you use the toilet aboard. So no comfort at all. And of course, during the crossing, sometimes we had to improvise and do some stunts to get the, you know, the sails up and to make some repairs aboard. And sometimes even did happen. The ship tipped over all the way and that long yard sometimes went into the water. So yeah, it's an adventure, of course. There were some risks involved. Everybody was a volunteer. Everybody was happy to be aboard, but we had to be very careful because once you start crossing an ocean or crossing from one place to the other, there's no turning back on that ship. We had to keep with the wind and the currents. Here's an example. This is us. We are going, I think this is crossing south of Africa, South Africa. It's Cape of Good Hope. The waves are just picking up. There's a lot of wind. We got like, I think like 40 knots of wind. So very, very scary. And the waves washed all over this deck. So it wasn't very, very funny, but of course we are prepared for that. And that's Philip and me, of course, just to adjust the sail in this ship. And people who sail, they know how easy it can be these days. Like one person or two can control a 50 footer. This is a 60 footer, but just to adjust the sail, we have to go around and move 8 to 10 ropes, cables. So it's not very easy. You have to really think before you do any movements because it's very heavy and it's very, you know, different primitive way of sailing. And of course the sail, this long voyage, it was a 2 years voyage around Africa. We had to do a lot of maintenance, basically rebuild the ship every day. Something like sailing happens every day, something breaks. So I have to keep and rebuild the whole thing. And this is us trying to hold the ship down without stopping it. So trying to hold the sail down so we could saw this rip in the sail. Sometimes it works, sometimes we had to stop and put everything down. And then of course, if you had to put the sail down, it was a good moment. So you could jump in the water, do some swimming. And how did you know how long you could stay in the water? Until somebody aboard saw the first tip of the shark. So that's time to go back to the ship. So we swim around until we saw some sharks and then we had to go back to the ship. And of course, a lot of animals, a lot of marine animals follow us all the way around the African continent. And here's inside the cabin. There was a small table, all the meals, everything was prepared here. And the moment to socialize, to share, you know, pictures, information also was aboard this cabin. Here's another moment. We put a dinghy in the water. That's in the middle of the Indian Ocean. And we had some time to spare so we could go out and do some filming for the documentary we produced it. And you can see it's a very small ship, 60 foot or 20 meters, but that was home for us for 2 years in all those oceans, all the seas around Africa in this first voyage. Now, you remember on those days, even today, we had the Somali pirates going around. By coincidence, this is Philip, Captain Philip, our captain. And we also had a movie with Tom Hanks called Captain Philip about the pirate attack, Somali pirate attack of a cargo ship, American cargo ship. Well, that movie is based on a true story that happened in, I think it was April in 2009. We were there in October 2009. So when we were there, we had some 1,500 small pirate ships around that area. So a crossing that would take us only 2 weeks from Salalah in Oman all the way to Zanzibar. Instead of 2 weeks, we had to sail for 8 weeks. We got reports from pirate attacks and we had to keep going sailing more and more to the east to avoid the pirates. And the only means of defense we had was this gun. It's an LRAD. It's a sonar gun. You can point this to the pirates. And if it's close enough, there's a very, you know, loud sound. And they say it can make the person blind for a few minutes or even cook your brain if you're too near. Of course, you had to have the pirate in front of you for that thing to work. So not very efficient in our situation. Anyway, this was the only possible weapon we could have to try to steer the pirates away. If you think the pirates, why would they want to, you know, attack a Phoenician ship that looks like a pirate ship, actually? We look like the Pirates of Caribbean ship, of course. But why would they like to attack us, the pirates of Somalia? Because these guys, they sail with very small vessels. There's a mother ship, and each mother ship has 10 to 20 small skiffs, small boats. And they go out there and stay there for weeks looking for a cargo ship, a prey. So if they see you in the water, doesn't matter your size, they want your water, they want your food, they want anything you have. And Europeans, of course, Europeans are a good price. They can use that as a hostage. So it was kind of dangerous. We sailed for 8 weeks blind. We didn't have any radar. We didn't have any lights during the night. No radio contact, trying to avoid the pirates. And we did have some close contacts. We had at least one night where a light followed us for a few hours. So it was very, very scary. Everybody aboard was very scared at this situation. But luckily, after 8 weeks, not two that we planned, 8 weeks, we managed to get all the way to Mayotte. And this is our crew. We had in that crossing in the Somali area, we had five sailors from Oman, three Indonesians, a Swedish guy, Nicholas, Philip, British, and me, Brazilian. So we are three infidels. And the guys were from Islam, they were Muslim, and they used to pray every day, which was nice. They had this, like a small mosque aboard. So every day, 3 to 5 times a day, they would pray. And it was nice, a cultural change for us to see. Actually, it did leave us with a little bit of problem in the water. And that's a funny story. It's funny now to tell, but not at the moment. The thing is, we set sail with 3,000 liters of water, 3 tons of water. So we think 1 ton of water we're going to drink, 1 ton of water we're going to wash our stuff or, you know, cook, and 1 ton it's for emergency or, you know, anything that we, if you say it, have to stay longer. So 3 tons seemed to be enough for 2 weeks from Salalah to Zanzibar. Of course, it took us 8 weeks, like I said, 6 week longer than we planned because of the pirates of Somalia. And we didn't account for one thing. If you pray for Allah, you have to wash yourself each time you pray. So these 8 guys washing themselves 5 times a day, it's almost a ton of water in 8 weeks. So we didn't plan for that. So that's a little cultural thing we overlooked. We didn't even realize it could be a problem. But yeah, they were very straight. Yeah, we have to wash before our prayers. So it's going to cost a ton of water if you stay 2 months sailing. So I had to, you know, reason with them, talk to them a lot. And it's very difficult in the situation because you don't want to offend anybody in the beliefs, of course, in cultural difference. But it was going to become a problem of life or death in the water. I mean, there was nowhere we could stop in those 8 weeks because of the pirates, and we were away in the middle of the ocean. So at the end, we managed to talk to them, and they found out they could pray only 3 times a day. And instead of using a liter of water to wash, just like a token, just like a half a glass of water, fresh water to wash. And of course, we tried to ask them, why not use the seawater? Because Allah is watching us. Allah is watching us, and He knows we have fresh water aboard. So we must use fresh water until we run out of fresh water. Then we can use salt water. So you cannot argue. We have to agree and accommodate. So that's what we did. At the end, we arrived there in Mayotte. Almost without water. But anyway, we preserve all this cultural, we respect all the religion, and we did okay at the end of the water, even though if it was another week, we could be in some trouble. And this is Philip dressed as Neptune, baptizing the guys. Of course, it's an old tradition. When you cross the equator first time, you have to baptize people who never crossed. And there's a German from Indonesia dressed as Neptune's ID. And after 2 years going around Africa, all this perils, all this adventure, we finally arrived at Syria, Lebanon first and Syria. And of course, we had a hero's reception. There was a lot of small parties. They started to grow bigger and bigger until we got back to Arwad. So it was a big celebration. And they said to this day, of course, it was 2008, soon after started the civil war and still continue. But for that moment, it was the most television, the most propagated event in the history of Syria at that moment. So it was very, very nice to be part of this expedition. I have a clip. It's a 3 minutes video that shows the whole thing, the 2 years of voyage in 3 minutes. We'll be right back. So let's continue. I hope you liked the video. That was an expedition we did from 2008 to 2010. And we proved that we could sail around Africa because we follow a document. Herodotus, the father of history, he said the Phoenicians were the first ones to go around Africa under the commandment of a pharaoh, Necho II. So to prove that Herodotus was right, that's why we did that. We went around Africa and we proved that really the Portuguese were not the first. Maybe the Phoenicians were the first. When we finished the expedition in 2010, the idea and Philip's ambition was to go to America. And mine was, of course, to bring the ship to Brazil. Philip decided to take the ship to America. I joined him again. And then we programmed to do this expedition. And that's what we started last September. We set sail, and this is our ship again, in the middle of the ocean. We started in Tunisia, in Carthage. Carthage, of course, it was the greatest of the Phoenician colonies outside of Lebanon. Carthage, if you remember your lesson of history, there's the Hannibal, the general that almost conquered Rome. And then Rome destroyed the Carthaginians because of a political thing. It's a long plot of history. Anyway, these guys from Carthage, they were the richest men, the richest, most powerful sailors and traders in the ancient world. And they had some 300 colonies, some say, all around Mediterranean and all the way down to Mogador, to Morocco. So that's where we decided to start our expedition. So we started in September last year. Carthage was very nice because it was a place very rich. And this is Hassan, he's a friend of the expedition. He's a Club de Dom member. And he is a guy dedicated to do this. He does the purple dye the way the Phoenicians did. He goes and gets some sea animals, some mussels, and they crush them. It's a very long, a very tedious and very smelly way to do that. You have to cook the smell, the snails and stuff. And then you have this little, just very tiny bits of ink that comes off of those mussels. And then you have to cook them. And then you make this dye, and you can dye cotton, any kind of fabric. And it's so expensive today. I think today it's like $200 for a small, pot of this dye. But in those days, it cost more than gold. Its own weight more than gold because it was the color of the kings and all the nobility wanted to wear. Of course, nowadays you want to have your Jaguar, your Lamborghini. Those days you want to have a purple tunic from Phoenicia or from Carthage. We document everything. It's always going to be in the documentary we're preparing. This is Hassan on his house, his workshop, preparing the purple dye for us, the same way the Phoenicians did 3,000 years ago. And here's the people from the Club de Dom. There's our friends. The second from the left is Erish. She's the president of Club de Dom. And they're very good friends of us. They really went out of their way to have a place for us to start expedition and give us provision and all the government or permissions they needed. And even we had this reception for a few ministers of the Tunisian government. It was a very good start. And if you want, we have some videos in our channel, YouTube channel. It's Canal Sanada, the YouTube channel. You can watch the start later after this discussion. You can go to the YouTube channel and watch the start of the expedition in Carthage. And also there's a clip about Morocco later on. So we start in September from Tunisia and we sail in a very difficult way. Actually, it was more difficult to sail from Tunisia out to the Atlantic Ocean than crossing the Atlantic Ocean itself. So it took us a long, long time because in the Mediterranean, all the winds and all the currents, they are very, very funny. Depending on the area we are sailing, it's going to be very tricky to sail a square rigged ship like that, very heavy. And this is something we did, actually I did every day. We made an agreement with UN Environment. They have this Clean Seas campaign, which is a very nice thing that they're doing. They are mapping all the plastic pollution in the oceans. So what we did is every day at the same time, and because we have the ship's log, so we know the position, the temperature of the water, we know the pH in the water, everything, and the time, we get a sample of the water. We're measuring now how many particles of microparticles of plastic are in those samples. So we're going to have the data soon from Tunisia all the way to Florida of how many microparticles of plastic are in the ocean. We took the samples from about 1 meter below the surface every day at the same time around 4 p.m. when we change our shift. And it's being analyzed now. Of course, this pandemic is slowing the process down, but we're going to have this out for the public to see, analyze, and people can do some studies on that. We thought it was a very good idea to do that because we're a very slow moving ship and we almost went with the tides current. So we could measure in a very efficient way.
Ah, here's again, here's our toilet.
It's a little lower if you remember the picture before. It's not so nice, but still the only toilet we had aboard, the only fun we had was in a bucket of water. Unless, of course, the ship stopped for some repair and then we could jump in the water. And that was a lot of fun. A few times we went into the ocean just to swim. And of course, if you had a chance to swim in the ocean, in the blue ocean, it's amazing. It's one of the best dives I ever did in my life, where the ones in the middle of the ocean, all this blue and the light goes very, very deep. If you dive like midday, you can see all the light going very, very deep. So it's very, very fun. And of course, you can sometimes encounter animals. This is a nice, this is something I remember for the rest of my life. We were swimming. And I had my camera with me, of course, all the time, and doing some repair on the ship as well. And then we looked, and there were some pilot whales coming towards the ship. So I swam to them. They all fled. This one, he stayed behind. And then as I approached it, like 3 meters, 9 feet from this animal, she turned and looked straight into my eyes and kept looking for like 30 seconds underwater. It looked like eternity. It was a very, very nice, very dramatic, very emotional encounter I had with this beautiful pilot whale. And this is our crew, part of our crew. This guy to the left, he's Steiner. He's a captain of Viking ships. We had two Norwegians, and Steiner is a real captain of Viking ships in Norway. And we kind of joked, he came aboard as a spy to report to the king of Norway that the Phoenicians were not the first, but the Vikings were the first to come to the Americas. So as a kind of private joke there. And there's Shema from Lebanon and Jirma from Indonesia. And that's our shift. Of course, a ship sailing across the ocean, you can never stop. You don't go to sleep and put the sails down and go to sleep, no. So we have two or three teams, depending on the leg. The teams, they take turns. And then one team is cooking and preparing everything and navigation. The other team is sleeping. And then it goes on until we reach land other side. And of course, and being a small ship and this crossing of the ocean, Atlantic Ocean, we had 12 people aboard, 12 crew members. And we didn't have enough space to sleep. So we had to shift so people could sleep and use the space below the cabin, which would be the cargo area for those Phoenicians in the old days. And the rest of the people be on the cabin, on top, on the deck, doing the work, all the work needed to keep the ship sailing. And this is a pie I made. Of course, when you sail and you cross an ocean, just like what we're doing now in the pandemics, everybody is locked at the home. Of course, we're locked in a small, very small area. The ship is 20 meters, so it's a 6 feet long ship. It's very, very small for 12 people. So one of the ways to break this boredom, to make things more interesting, are the meals. So we had to do a good meal. Each team do their best to impress the next team. And I start to make some pies. Like I think this is an apple pie or pineapple pie with the Phoenician ship on top. And of course, we always had to do some repairs, like before, going around Africa, and this crossing the ocean as well, we had to do repairs. And this is us, I think that's me, trying to repair the rudder from the water. And you can see the ships are still moving. We couldn't stop really very well. Ship across the ocean, there's a current and the winds, even though the sails might be down, you are still moving. So I have to be very, very careful not to be left behind. Because like I said, a ship like that cannot turn. There's no way you can turn and sail against the current, against the winds. Once we left from Tenerife for the long crossing, that's it. It could not stop anywhere. We had to go all the way to Americas. And like I said, sometimes we had to do repairs. So that's standing again, doing some sewing on the sails. Just lower a little bit and put some people to work and get it repaired so we could keep sailing again. Now that's a funny story. We had an intruder aboard. We had a rat from Tenerife. For some reason, a rat came aboard. It was kind of a joke at the beginning. It was small mice trying our food, eating an apple here, eating something left in the cabin there. But then it starts to chew on the plastic containers for our food and it starts to leave his marks all over the ship. So it became really a dangerous thing. Animal like that, even though it's small, it can contaminate our water, our food. And like I said, there's no way, there's no supermarket inside. We detect this guy 3 days after Tenerife, and we had another 37 days ahead of us. So we didn't know how long at the time. So what could we do? So the first idea, Philip's idea, was to smoking out. Well, actually, there was a vote. We had 12 of us aboard, 12. 11 voted to smoke the rat out. Only two voted against, me and the rat, and we lost. So what we did is we closed all the ship, put all the exhaust pipes from the engine for generator inside, and run the diesel or the generator and the engine for, I don't know, 2 hours. So all the smoke was supposed to have, you know, make the rat come out or at least kill him, but it didn't work. So we had a little competition aboard, who could make a trap? And that's me making the trap to finally got the rat. And I made a little joke, of course, Minnie Mouse nightclub. So after a week, trying, and the rat went for an apple. He was really thirsty, he needed some water, so there was a water in the apple. He went for the apple and we got the little animal, a poor guy. Here's just to summarize, here's a few slides showing where we stopped. When we left Tunisia, in Carthage, a very, very nice place. I recommend people who doesn't know Tunisia should go there to visit because it's a wonderful place. The first stop in unintended was Algeria. Of course, Algeria, it's a kind of, you know, closed country. You can't go there without a visa. It's very difficult to get a visa sometimes. We had three Americans aboard this leg from Tunisia to Cadiz to Spain. But we had some problems with the mast. The tip of the mast was breaking because there was a crack in the top of the mast last 3 feet. So I had to cut it down. So we had to stop in Algeria. It took us a long time to get the permission to go in, but everybody was so friendly. The only thing was we stayed there 3 days. We could not leave the harbor only by special permission. But luckily the security officer of the harbor, he was a very nice guy. He took us to a tour of Algeria. So that was fun. Then we went from there to Cadiz, to Spain, a beautiful place as well, where the, you know, the Spanish left to go to the New World in the 1500s. From there, Tenerife, like I said, that's where we got our rat, our 13th passenger. And we sailed from here all the way then to the Americas. Before that, we stopped at Thor Heyerdahl's Museum in Tenerife, which is a very nice place. And Dave, he's the guy who is the manager of the museum, he received us. And it was a very, very nice meeting because for then, what we did was very important. Proved that some of the theories of Thor Heyerdahl, of the Quimar pyramids, which is a mystery in itself. Nobody really knows what's happening there. We built these pyramids, built thousands of years ago, or maybe less than that. Anyway, so what we did, crossing the ocean in an ancient ship, it really completed the Thor Heyerdahl's work, according to David. So that was very nice. And Essaouira is nice because it's one of the places that was used in that series, HBO series, Game of Thrones. So this very, very beautiful place. And we had there, stayed for a week over there. It was very nice. And we received some schools, some children came aboard to learn about their history. Mogador or Essaouira was outside into the Atlantic Ocean, outside the Mediterranean. And the Phoenicians, they used to have a place there, a small island, where they exported iron to all around Africa from that small place 3,000 years ago. So it's amazing. What we believe this ancient people, they didn't get around, they didn't, you know, trade, but they did. From this small place in the middle of nowhere in Morocco, they would export iron to all over the Africa and Mediterranean. They also have a very nice organization there, a cultural club, and they give us a very nice reception. So we set sail again. And then there was this 39 days going all the way to the Americas. And then we arrived after 39 days to Santo Domingo, in Dominican Republic. And we had a very nice reception at the officers club, which was our official reception for the first Phoenician ship to arrive in America in 2,600 years, or maybe the first one ever. And from there, we sailed for another week and then we arrived in Florida. Also a very nice reception. This is the fire and rescue department ships or boats gave us a salute as we arrived there. And they stayed for a long time in Florida, Fort Lauderdale, very nice reception there. And also in Miami, where the ship is still in American soil this day. Now here's part of the crew that made it, the crew who arrived in America. They're all here, made it, plus a few other American friends that sail in the Mediterranean with us too. Now here's a nice picture of us in front of Coral Ridge Yacht Club in Fort Lauderdale when they arrived. That's February 4th. The Phoenicians, after 2,600 years, made it to America. I believe they did that before. They did that in Solomon times. But if not, this is the first ship that ever made it to America, which is very nice to be part of too. So that's all the presentation I have of those two voyages going around Africa and sailing all the way to America.
Thank you, Yuri. That was fascinating. It certainly shows the trials and tribulations of ocean crossings, and that are all very familiar to some of us who have done similar expeditions, and all the challenges and the sometimes the odd stories that come up, right, with bringing on board mice on purpose. that's a new one I've never heard before. We have some questions from our members and followers. The first one is whenever you reached a new port, a new location, what did you look forward to at the most? Was it always something different, or was it something you wanted to do, or was it the same each stop? You just wanted to find new food, better food, clean water, and shower, or this question is by Diana Wable Swanson.
Okay, when you got first to a port, well, for me, like I said, I was doing the documentary, right? So each port we went in both voyages around Africa and also just across America, we tried to look for evidence of Phoenicians there, or something that indicated that maybe, why would the Phoenicians be there? So for instance, why Cadiz? Gadir was the most, you know, successful city. Maybe it's the first city in Europe, in modern Europe, and it was a Phoenician port. So when they're looking for ruins, for all the evidence. So most of the crew, they, of course, they go to ice cream. They go for something ice. Of course, it's very nice. I do that too. But for me, it's like a list of where to go and where to find the evidence of Phoenicians here, so we can document. I can use this opportunity to have this Phoenician ship as a background and bring people, interview historians and people from that area, so to make a better documentary. That's what I always did.
Another question goes to the ship itself, and how this is asked by my colleague Santiago Pardo Sanchez. And how was the ship built? What was the construction? And why was that particular ship chosen? And someone else asked how you chose the crew.
Okay, well, actually, the ship was built by Philip in 2008. And he went around for 2 years looking for the perfect Phoenician ship to make this voyage. And of course, the success of finding the shipwrecks, as Jules Verne, that you showed in the map, because the shipwrecks, they were almost, you know, the raw part intact. So they made a very good basis from where to draw to make the blueprints for the ship. They're smaller than the Phoenician. They're a bit smaller. Phoenician's a little larger, but the same ratio. So it's an authentic Mediterranean ship from 600 BC. So that's a cargo ship. The Phoenicians, of course, they had the warships. Even though they were Pacific, the Carthaginians, they had the warships, very efficient, and they almost destroyed the Roman armada. And they were the rulers of the Mediterranean for a long time. But of course, a warship wouldn't cross the ocean as well as this ship did. And if you see the pictures, and of course you saw some pictures and you saw the video, it's kind of round underneath it. So it moves a lot. But with a lot of cargo, they would carry those days. And there's some people who wrote, some Greeks who wrote about them, how great the Phoenicians were. They would even melt their anchors and made anchors of silver to bring back for their voyage. So everything was some cargo for the Phoenicians. So that was the best ship ever designed, I think, in those days to cross the ocean. If you think it's a 2600 design, we on the white coast of South Africa, we reached 10.7 knots of speed. So that was very, of course, there was the current and the winds, but it's a very, very good speed for today, a modern sailboat. Imagine a boat designed 3,000 years ago.
Yeah, usually our cruising speed on a modern cruiser is 7 knots when you want an average, if you're not running a super fast, super light boat, 7 knots is the best you can hope for.
And of course, we are not Phoenicians, so we didn't know what we're doing. We're learning, right, by doing it. So
and your sails are made out of cotton, right? They're made out of cotton. They're not even made out of mylar or anything modern that remotely can resemble what we use today. So they're porous. The air goes through the cotton.
Yeah.
We have other questions. Did you use the diesel engine at all? How much?
Yeah, well, the engine was, like I said, necessary because of nowadays you cannot leave. Some countries don't even let you go out of the harbor without an engine or some safety equipment. When you go to some places, you go into a harbor
and there's all the ships, ship lanes, all the ships go in and out. And
they won't consider you being special because you are a historical ship. They don't care. I mean, the sailor coming back from going to his family, he wants to go home. So he wouldn't stay and wait for you to sail at 1 knot into the harbor. So you must have either have an engine aboard or you need to hire every time somebody to take you in. And sometimes places we went, they wouldn't have anybody to help us anyway. So yeah, actually the ship left Egypt first without an engine. The engine was put aboard in Sudan in 2008. Wow. It was very difficult operation, yeah. But it was very, very expensive there. It was very bad design, the way they put the engine on, but that's all we could do at the time. So yeah, nowadays, any expedition, I think you have to have at least a means of get out of the way of this cargo ship that's crossing at 30 knots. I mean, they're not going to look for you in the radar. They're usually sleeping, they don't care. They're just gonna run over you. So you must be able to get out of this way.
That's absolutely true. It's in fact, that's the main cause of most ship strikes for whales as well. And you're not much bigger than a whale or much different than a whale on a radar. You don't show, essentially, and neither do them, neither do they, excuse me, or even on sonar. And that's why we have so many ship strikes that hit whales, because nobody's actually at the wheel on a ship, on the big tankers or the big cargo ships. Everything is automated. We have another question that's actually very interesting. They ask why, how, and if we understood correctly, you went from you crossed from Port Suez to Port Said, so across the Red Sea before, obviously, the Suez Canal. Did you do that, or did the Phoenicians do that, or is it documented they did that? I'm not particularly familiar, so. Well, defer to you.
It's interesting. Well, like I said, the expedition around Africa was commissioned by Pharaoh, Egyptian Pharaoh Necho II, okay, to the Phoenician sailors. So the Necho II, he wanted to learn to know if the Egypt would go all the way to the south. They would find more land or ocean. So history says, and the others wrote, that this Pharaoh, Necho II, asked Phoenicians to do that, to go around and see if he can go around Africa and come back to the Pillars of Hercules. The thing is, Necho II is the guy who started the Suez Canal. He's the Pharaoh who started digging there all those years ago. It's not something new. I mean, now, of course, it's modern, everything. It's been done past centuries, but even years, 1,000 years ago, that was the guy who designed and start to build the Suez Canal. That, mm-hmm. Of course, a different name. I don't know the name there. But there was the same Pharaoh, Necho II.
Oh, interesting. Very interesting. What was the speed when you were doing repairs in the ocean? What was the ship was still moving? What was the speed?
Average speed for Phoenicia was 2-3 knots. That was our average speed. Average. In most of the ocean, if we had a good current and a good wind pushing us. So if the sails down, we'd go less than a knot, I'd say, depending on the situation, the place. But like in the middle of the ocean, like when we went to swim with the whales, and we did that like 2 or 3 times in this last crossing, it was less than a knot, almost stopped.
Okay. And yet, perhaps, and yet it felt a lot faster, right, when you were in the water.
Yeah.
It always does. You think you're not moving, but you're moving. There are people watching, by the way, from Norway. Our chair of lectures, Ann Passer, is telling me that we have people watching from Norway. In fact, I think we have fellow director of the Explorers Club, Zenobia Marie Klam, who has worked at the Kon-Tiki Museum. When you visited the one in Tenerife, she worked at the one in Oslo. So hi, Zenobia. I showed the Kon-Tiki map again, just for you. I think we have also people from Brazil and Carthage and all over the United States. And we have also, I think that's the last question, is if you carried backups of everything that you needed to correct, to repair, so for your sales and other things. And perhaps when you tell us about the repairs you've made, you can also tell us about your incredible handiwork and your ability to fix things and be creative, and how you applied that to your house and studio in Brazil.
Yeah, well, actually, during the cross, yes, you must. Well, before I lived inland, me and my wife, we lived for 12 years aboard sailboats. So we know that we have to always carry a lot of stuff to fix things in the middle of the ocean. There's no way we're going to call repairman. And if they come, it's going to be like a big, big, you know, charge for you to fix your like toilet in the middle of the ocean. So anyway, you have to carry everything you can. Of course, Phoenicia being an ancient vessel, a traditional vessel, it's a bit easier because it's wood. It's, you know, some basic tools. You can almost repair everything. Like you can sew the sail, and you can fix the hull, like we did, even underway, and fix the rudders. And some unexpected things, like, you know, the rat that came aboard. How we catch a rat in the middle of the ocean? So we had to come up with a design of a trap that would work. We did three. There was the Indonesian trap, there was the English trap, and there was the Brazilian trap that mine got the rat. So that's something you never, you know, imagine we have this kind of problems, but then you have. And sailing around Africa, we, like I said, we did have problem with lack of water, and we did have to get some water from the rainwater to cook with, otherwise we'd be in trouble. And we didn't prepare for that. So it's a matter of getting canvas, getting all the wood to have, and make some contraption so you can get, you know, all the water and store it safely so you adapt. Of course, everybody who came to the expedition, and everybody was a volunteer in this kind of a project. That's Philip's Bill project. I joined as, you know, a partner for the documentary. And being a sailor, I think I helped a lot in many, many things. But everybody who came aboard from the Viking, two Vikings we had aboard from Norway, and Indonesian people, and the guys from America, and the guys from everywhere. We had like, I think, 15 countries participating as crew members, volunteers. Everybody brought a little bit of their experience aboard, and that mix made us very powerful. I mean, we could have, and for one problem, 10 different ideas, and everybody collaborating like a big family. We reached a very good result every time. So we made it safely in both journeys. Imagine 2 years around Africa, and then 5 months from Tunisia all the way to America, for 39 days crossing the Atlantic, and we did very well. Because of the crew we have, because all the everybody, all the talents aboard.
It's a wonderful project. United so many people of so many different cultures, as my colleague Ann Passer has just very astutely pointed out. And it's true, in fact, that these projects, these crossings, form families out of very different people. Right? It's happened for Kon-Tiki, and it's happening. It's happened for you, and it's happened for many others who have tried similar crossings, similar expeditions for science and for exploration. Would you like to show us the sustainability piece of your house very quickly that connects with the Clean Oceans Initiative from the United Nations, as you mentioned?
Sure, yeah. Well, we've been environmentalists for a long, long time, my wife and I, Vera and I. And when we decided to build a house in Brazil, a place to live in, after living for 12 years aboard a sailboat, a 50-footer that we sank in a storm, we decided to live aboard, you know, to live in
land. So we didn't decide to have a normal house. We went to
a sailboat inland. Because a sailboat, as you
know, sailing, we have to be self-sufficient. Why a house cannot be self-sufficient?
That's what we did. We built a house first with old tires. We have here, I think, 7,000 to 8,000
old tires that would be otherwise in the rivers,
in the oceans. And that's, we put, you know, to make walls and pet bottles on the roof. And the roof, it's green. It's all grass. So it's a very nice way to build and also very efficient. We don't have air conditioning, even though in the summer in Brazil it's very, very hot. We don't need air conditioning. We don't need a big heater in the winter. Everything is supposed to save energy, not only the construction itself, get the garbage and make it into a house, but also save energy over time. And that's what we're doing. So everything here has a different design. And of course, people can go to our YouTube channel, and we're going to be posting more and more videos and showing the house. You can see how we built this house. And you guys are invited to come here and visit too, of course.
Perhaps that's the best way to see it. Last question from, I'm sorry, Erige. I hope I'm not mispronouncing your name. From Carthage, do you have any future projects?
Yeah, well, Erige is the president of Clube de Dom. She was the girl who really helped us. She was amazing. And we started very well from Tunisia because of that foundation that she started in Tunisia. We have many projects. We're doing a few projects with America, a few movies. One, it's actually a movie about it's going to be also an adventure project about Gidon, a princess Mediterranean. If you think that's a nice thing for these days. 2,000 years ago, in Tunis, in Carthage, they built a university for women. 2,000 years ago. The next time it happened, it was in Europe. I mean, 2,000 years later. So think about the rights, human rights. So these guys were, the Phoenicians, a lot ahead of their time. And we don't give them credit enough. So that's good to mention, because if you think about ancient people, we tend to think, they didn't know, they were poor people. But if you look into that and you get to the evidence, archaeological, and you really sail on those ships like we did, we really walk in their shoes, you know how much better maybe, how smart they were, they really were. So that's a project where we're working together, one of the movies we're working.
Fantastic. Thank you so much, Yuri. Thank you for entertaining us with these fantastic fantasies and stories from the ocean. And thank you all who tuned in to the Explorers Club tonight. We hope to keep this community together and rally around each other in the next few months, the next few weeks, and maintain connections strong. We'll have lectures every Monday at 7. Thank you so much and have a great evening.
You too. Thank you very much. Thank you, everybody.
Para acompanhar outros podcasts e lives, assine o canal do YouTube, Canal Sanada, e visite o site aventura.com.br para conteúdos exclusivos de aventuras, turismo, sustentabilidade e muito mais.